I also have the privilege this evening of introducing our final speaker, and I can say with full confidence that we're really ending on an up note. Mark Peter Keen is a man of multiple cultures. Having received his degree in landscape architecture from Cornell in 1979, he transplanted to Kyoto, Japan in the mid-1980s, serving first as a research fellow at the University of Kyoto and later as a member of its faculty in the Department of Environmental Design. Mark's life in Japan ultimately stretched for nearly 18 years, during which time he designed both private gardens, municipal gardens, and parks. He also wrote multiple books, and more on that in a moment. And he published numerous articles in garden design magazines. Oh, and he married. During his time in his adopted city, Mark also served as the chair of the Kyoto Mitate International Institute that works to revitalize Kyoto's unique cultural heritage. We are extraordinarily fortunate that Mark and his family have now adopted Ithaca as their hometown. I first became aware of Mark and his work when he contacted plantations wanting multiple stems from shrubs in order to utilize them in the construction of a tea house outside the Johnson Art Museum, which was a wonderful but ephemeral project. Mark is currently a research fellow at Cornell, and he recently designed and installed the James and Rebecca Morgan Tiger Glen Garden at the Johnson Museum. And those of you who have seen the Tiger Glen Garden know that it is an absolute gem. Even more recently, Mark designed the Six Friends Garden for Cornell Plantations, which we will have the pleasure of hearing about this evening. After Mark's lecture, he will be signing books in the foyer. One of the books with which I'm very familiar, Japanese Garden Design, has really become the standard text for the design of gardens in the Japanese tradition. Mark's newest book, Songs in the Garden, consisting of his poetry and other writing, will also be available for sale in the foyer. So, having gotten to know Mark over the past year plus, I can say that it has been a tremendous education each time we sit down to discuss the design of the Six Friends Garden. So it's with real pleasure that I now introduce Mark Peter Keen.
Thank you, Bobby. Hello, can you hear me in the back? This is working? Yes, good, okay. Today I'm going to talk to you about a garden I've designed for the plantations that hopefully we will get started building in some future month or year. The garden request from the plantations, the request for the design was to design an East Asian garden. You may realize that there is no such thing as an East Asian garden in the sense that if you go to China, you'll find Chinese gardens. In Japan, you'll find Japanese gardens. There really isn't an East Asian garden. So this was the great fun of this project, was taking the three cultures of China, Japan, and Korea, and drawing from them some aspects of the gardening culture and the surrounding culture, the literary culture, and designing a contemporary garden that is based on East Asian culture without actually mimicking precisely a garden that you would see in those three countries. How many people have traveled in any of those countries? Quite a lot, more than half. Great. I'm going to start with a very quick introduction to the gardens in those three places, mostly to refresh your memory for those who've been there and for people who haven't, to give you some idea of where the garden I designed is coming from. So to begin with, in China. Chinese gardens are very urban. They're very architectural. There are pavilions and plazas. The whole construction feels, very constructed. In 1630, there was a book written in China, translated, the title is translated as The Craft of Garden, which describes precisely how to make a garden. And the entire book is about architecture. It's how to build a pavilion, a balustrade, a window, tiles. And the very last chapter includes stones and plants. And you can see that the intention, the idea of what a garden is, was, for the Chinese people, was extremely architectural. Courtyards are often paved wall to wall, the plantings somewhat loose and wild, and on the edges, many enclosing walls. Often a large central lake for the larger gardens, and all around the surrounding area, covered walkways and small pavilions. These high walls that separate the various parts of the garden also offer opportunities for very clear doorways and windows that peek from one side to the other. So this aspect of peeking through from one court into another is an interesting aspect of Chinese garden design. Here's a beautiful framed view of the next section of this garden. I'll just point out one small thing up here, this name of the garden. You see there's actually a plaque on the wall. Chinese gardens have a very strong connection of literature and the garden, actually bringing plaques and written poetry into the garden. This name, it means essentially a garden, but this first character, the three strokes, for the Chinese people, it looks like the three strokes of a bamboo leaf. The name of the person who made this garden and many aspects about the garden, including the plantings right here, are bamboo connected. And that's why that character is there. I'm bringing this up because a little later on I'll talk more about the very many connections between poetry and literature and the gardens in East Asia. Another beautiful framed view through a doorway. Stones are very important in East Asian gardens, in gardens in China. In China, the stones are often these very fantastical limestone stones that were pulled up from the bottom of Lake Taihu. They are dissolved into these fantastic patterns, or in many cases, smaller stones are very carefully mortared together to make what looks like one big stone. And here again, we have an interesting connection where you see a pavilion in the garden. This pavilion is actually made of stone. So it's rather, in China, the pavilions can be quite sturdy. And it has a title and then a couplet poem written there. The name of the pavilion is the Blue Wave Pavilion. Blue Wave Pavilion. And the poem goes like this. There are cool breezes and the bright moon. They are always precious or priceless. The nearby waters and the distant mountain are all rich with meaning. So you can see that the person who built this garden and built the pavilion put that there to insert in the mind of the visitor a certain image that they would think about when they were sitting in the pavilion. And one last interesting quality of Chinese gardens is the decorative work on the surface of the ground, mosaic tiles, very beautiful, complex use of bits of stone or roof tiles, old roof tiles, to make paving patterns. And now we'll jump over to Japan. In Japan, there are many different types of gardens, of course, but this type, which uses sand and stone, is very well known. It's called kare sansui, the dry mountain water. So mountains and water created with materials that are dry, not with actually using any real water. These gardens can be at times extremely sparse and abstract. This is the famous stone garden at Ryoanji, where you have a very large external courtyard that's covered with white sand, raked, and just a few stones set in it to punctuate the space. The tea garden is the basis for most of the gardens that you see in Japan today and includes certain very characteristic elements like stone lanterns and water basins. The kind of arbors that you might find in a Japanese garden tend to be lighter, more delicate, the wood is not painted, more fragile than the ones you'd see in Chinese gardens. And the separation between sections of the garden, unlike the very high walls with the very clear, strong entries we saw in China, you might have gates like this that, in fact, you could walk around to the left or right. The gate is only there as a suggestion of entry. It isn't a really strong physical barrier. At times, water can be the central feature of a Japanese garden, too. And here's another image of both the water as the central feature and a pavilion that is of this lighter build, a bare wood fit together, rather light structure physically, and unadorned, not painted or colored in any way. The ground surface, instead of being entirely covered with mosaic tile as a kind of a urban courtyard, tends to be basically green, sometimes covered with moss, and the paving limited to the pathway that leads you through the garden. Sometimes a path like a running path like this, and sometimes broken up into stepping stones. And the division, again, between the spaces, rarely with high walls, very often with very ephemeral materials, sometimes bundled twigs, things like this, that need to be renewed every few years. And finally, in Korea, Korean gardens are often talked about as being uncultivated gardens. In other words, Korea does not have a strong tradition of a designed, artful garden. Their garden spaces are basically undeveloped. So in front of this residence, there's a packed earth space called the madang. And around the edge of the madang, maybe up here, maybe along the walls that border it, there'll be some plants planted that might be medicinal plants or fruiting plants or flowering plants that are used. But the whole thing is not designed as a garden per se. In the rear, this is a palace, so it's quite fully developed, but usually in the rear of the house, there would just be a grassy slope enclosed by a wall. And this inclusion of the surrounding natural world inside the wall is what counts for a garden in Korea. And in fact, sitting in a pavilion and looking out into the garden, or in fact, past the garden to the surrounding bamboo forest or pine forest or the distant mountains is the aspect of gardening in Korea. It's a place to be and look out into nature. The pavilions tend to be quite sturdy in their construction when compared to Japanese light pavilions. So, just to give you some examples of what I glean from all of this, you know, it's a difficult task to try and take something that's from all these cultures, because they are quite different. But there are some common threads, and a few of them are like this. The garden in East Asia is a meditation on the landscape or on nature. The purpose of the garden, the design of the garden, and the purpose of being in the garden is to meditate on, to be close with, natural rhythms. Not the design of mathematics or engineering or physical structures like that, so much as understanding the rhythms and patterns of the natural world. So that's one thing. The design tends to be asymmetrical, without a strong central axis. You know, in some garden designs, there'll be a strong central allée. Things are equal on both sides, or sometimes they're split into four patterns that balance in four directions. East Asian gardens tend to be asymmetric and having no axis in the center. The palette of materials that are used in these gardens is very limited. The materials used in the architecture and the walls and the plants, the stones, it's a very simple palette. The collection from nature of a huge assortment of materials, especially plants, and gathering them all into one place to show off the variety of colors in flower or leaf or textures is not the basis of gardening in East Asia. Rather, plants are brought in for symbolic reasons. The plant list in a garden might only be 5 or 10 species long. The materials used in the surrounding architecture and walls tend to be very simple and drawn from nature, have a very simple palette. Again, there's a very strong connection between literature and poetry in the gardens, because literature, well, especially poetry, but also stories in East Asia, use images of nature as a way of conveying the human spirit. So when you're looking in a garden and you see pines or rocks, rivers, streams, maples, willows, things like that, you are constantly reminded of images that you learned first from poems or stories. That connection shows up time and time again in different ways. And stones are important. They're more important than plants. The most ancient gardening treatise, written about 1,000 years ago in Japan, called the Sakuteiki, starts out with the first line being Ishi o taten koto, the art of setting stones. And that's how they said gardening in those days. They had no word or verb for gardening. The verb they used for gardening was to set a stone, because that was the primary act of making a garden. So this is a set of a few of the things that inform the design I did for the plantations. The garden, as Don told you, is called the Six Friends Garden. And as you will come to see, the six friends are six elements in the garden, five of them plants, one of them a stone, and they represent in East Asian culture certain aspects of the human spirit, certain virtues. Sometimes these aspects are very similar in all three cultures, Japan, China, and Korea, and sometimes they're slightly divergent, but they are important to all of them. The first one is the pine. Pine trees either grow on the rocky seashore or on the mountain cliffs, but they are seen as being images of longevity, of perseverance, of tenaciousness. And so in all of these cultures, in the poems and in literature and in the gardens, that's the way pines are thought of. This is a beautiful red pine in a Japanese garden, and a lacebark pine in a Chinese garden. You can see the Taihu stone here. The willow is one of the friends. The willow, with its graceful cascading leaves, the weeping willow, is seen as an image of gracefulness. The willow trees in East Asian gardens are often cut, pollarded. They're cut back to the trunk or close to the trunk each year. So what you end up with is a very thick, strong central trunk and some gnarly branches, and then these long cascades of fine twigs in the spring. And it's this sort of graceful, willowy quality that was seen as being the beauty of the willows. Stones, again, are extremely important. When a stone is put in an East Asian garden, it is a representation of a mountain. So I call them stones, but in fact you could call them mountains. The imagery in poems and in literature is always of a mountain, and that is represented in a garden with a standing stone. Like these elaborate and fantastical stones, really sculptural stones in a Chinese garden, or very simple natural boulders in a Japanese garden. A bamboo is one of the six friends. Bamboo grows so vigorously. You know, it comes out of the ground. You see a little shoot one day, it's 3 feet tall the next. Within 2 weeks, it's grown to its full height. So this has become an image of vitality in East Asian culture. The lotus is one of our friends. The lotus is a plant that has very strong connection with Buddhist religion. Because the lotus grows in a muddy pond, its roots way down in the thick mud at the bottom, but grows up above the water surface, the leaves lifting up above, and then the flower even further above that. And because it never gets stained with the muddy water, you know, I don't know if you know, but a lotus leaf has a very fine covering of hairs. And if you drop some water on it, they pearl up like liquid mercury. They don't stick, they roll around and fall off. So many poems talk about how the lotus, even though it grows in the mud, how do you stay so pure and clean? And so it's become an image of purity, of spiritual purity. And finally, the maple. The maples have this image of change, coming out in spring with a beautiful green leaf, deepening in summer, turning red in fall, and the leaves falling. They sort of mark the seasons and the change to the seasons. So they've become indicative of change. And now just a few images of what these six friends look like when made into a garden. This is the Nevin Welcome Center, and there is a plateau next to it, which used to hold the work shed and equipment shed for the plantations. And it's that plateau that we'd like to use to build this garden. The first courtyard is connected to the center as a both an entry to the Six Friends Gardens and also as a space for gathering and doing concerts and music, that sort of thing. It has pines in it and will become a pine courtyard. So the first friend is the pine. When you pass through and across this bridge, you enter a second courtyard that is defined by some light fences and surrounded by willows, which again would be pruned so that they have a central, strong trunk and cascades of weeping branches. And that's our second friend. Then turning the corner, there is here a stone arrangement. You've seen how there were stones in Chinese gardens, the Taihu stones that were very fantastical and sculptural, and in Japanese gardens, just simple natural boulders set. This is a new way, a contemporary way, that I'm expressing the landscape in stone. If you were to be able to look at the natural landscape over a long period of time, hundreds of millions of years, you would see it moving, rising and falling, tectonic plates shifting, the land sort of cascading in waves, things that we can't see at our life scale, our time scale, but are actually real. And the wave-like motion of this stone arrangement is intended to express, in a sculptural way, the inherent wave-like motion of the natural world, something that we never see, but is actually the quality of geological time. Behind that, as acting as a backdrop for this sculpture, is a rammed earth wall. It's an earth wall made out of soil that is rammed, pounded into a form in layers, and it ends up creating a painting of a landscape, mountains and distant mountains, clouds, that sort of thing. So this use of soil as a painting is again a contemporary expression of the soil walls in East Asian gardens. There are groves of bamboo that one walks to after that. And the arbor, which I'll talk more about in a bit, also has bamboo infill, sort of like a basket-like bamboo weave. So there's bamboo in different forms in this part of the garden. The passing through the bamboo, one comes to a small courtyard in the back that has lotus growing inside it. Not a lot of lotus, but lotus almost like a flower arrangement growing in the middle of a small pond. Underneath the gravel here, in a way that's hidden, you don't actually see the devices, but there will be a series of water harps. Water harps are buried ceramic urns that allow water to drip into them slowly and have a small pool of water at the bottom. And as the water drips in and hits the pool, it kind of goes bling, bling, and that's called a water harp in Japanese. So when you come in this courtyard, the purpose of having this small entry and enclosure is to increase the sound of the water harps, a sound that will be quite subtle, but hopefully fill that space in a nice way. And then returning, one walks through the grove of Japanese maples that is connected to and actually flows up and into the knoll. So looking from here on these stones where you can sit, you'll be able to connect to the azalea connection and the pines that are already growing on the knoll itself. This pavilion is a design that is contemporary, obviously. It has certain connections to East Asian architecture and certain aspects that are non-traditional. In general, the beauty and design comes from the expression of the structure itself. This is true of East Asian architecture. Mostly East Asian architecture is post and beam when it's wood. So this is a post and beam structure, and the structure of the legs and of the roof read through and become the patterning of the design itself. So a shape that is drawing from the structural qualities of East Asian architecture without copying exactly a particular form from any country or any era. It also has the ability to be switched. You can see here, mostly it will be in this form when people are coming through, but by installing tatami mats, you can turn it into a Japanese tea room for doing the Japanese tea ceremony. This is a view from the back. Again, it would be normally set up just without any infill, but if you put in tatami and hang a scroll, put a flower in, you can do tea ceremony in there. And we'll finish up just with a short movie which takes you on a little walkthrough through the garden. Thank you. Thank you.
So I think we have time for questions,
sure.
Mark,
yeah.
And I'd like to lead off with the first one. Can you talk a bit more about the materials that will be used to create the walls both for the pine court and the lotus court?
The dark walls that you saw, which were either red or white on the inside, are wooden walls on a stone foundation that would either be made out of charred wood. Charring cedar as a preservative method is an interesting technique used in East Asia, or they'll be stained dark. It's really a question of funding on which one we do. But so dark walls, and then the inside surface is plastered with a Japanese lime plaster called shikui. It's a very interesting lime plaster that includes fine fibers that hold it together and creates a very beautiful, smooth surface. You got it, Six Friends Garden, yes. How did you guess?
Are there other places in the garden where there will be other poetry you're seeing?
Well, I don't think so. In Chinese gardens, plaques are put in the garden, on the pavilions, on the walls, at the gates, very specifically. In Japanese and, of course, in Korean gardens, they aren't. What I'd like to do is have a very strong component of connecting literature and the gardens, probably through printed material, a book, a booklet, that you can take into the garden where people will contribute. I have friends who are Korean, Japanese, and Chinese who are poets who would contribute historical or personal poems on those six themes. So that would have a starter kit, so to speak, where you can understand how in those three cultures, those six themes are brought into poetry. And then I also hope that other local poets and professors will bring people to the garden and do poetry classes and literature classes there to follow up on that idea as well. Yes, just behind you.
Every Japanese or Asian garden I've ever heard of in the States, they brought over craftspeople from Asia to do the different techniques. Will you be doing that? Will you be finding local people who are able to?
We probably won't be bringing people from Asia. If I was doing a Japanese garden as a classic garden, I might bring over Japanese craftspeople. If I was doing a Chinese garden in the traditional way, I might bring over Chinese tile workers or something like that. But I've tried to design this garden so that it can be done, built, using the skills of American craftspeople. There may be some people, like I know a person who does shikui plastering. It's a very special art. You have to be trained in that kind of plastering and the use of the material. So there'll be people who have certain skills that are not typical, but I don't think we'll be bringing people over from Asia for this. Yeah?
One of the aspects of the garden that you listed was a garden as a meditation on the landscape. And for me, meditation is very much about awareness and being in the present moment. But a lot of the plantations for me is about losing myself entirely, getting as far away from campus and my life here as possible. How do you hope to balance those two dynamics in this garden? On the one hand, total awareness, and on the other, just getting away from it all.
They're exactly the same. You've answered your own question. And I'm not being facetious, but they are exactly one and the same. To be in the moment is to be removed from all those daily cares. Good point. Thank you for making it.
And if I could just build on that for a moment, Mark, my sense is that when one will be in the Six Friends Garden, either strolling through it or seated in one area, one will be very much aware of that garden and not so much of the other parts of the plantations.
Yeah, most of the courtyards are strongly enclosed. That was a feature I really wanted to have You disappear into them and you move from section to section. And then in the back where the maples are, it also flows up and into the knoll. So there is a part of the garden that is segued into the plantations and part of it that is a world apart. Any other questions in the back? The question was, to what extent have East Asian gardens incorporated Western design features through the contact that's happened over the last, well, it goes back maybe to the 1500s, so quite a while. There hasn't been all that much. When you see it, you know it quite clearly. For instance, there'll be lawns put in large Japanese gardens, you know, that sort of thing that happened from the 1800s on. We won't be bringing any of those back home to roost, though. And I really can't think of any other particular aspects of Western gardening design that went into Asian quite strongly. It happened in reverse a lot. And of course, if you look at the botanical names of plants we use, there's so many Japonicus and Chinensis that you know the plant material often comes from East Asia as well. The reverse is not as true. Good question, though. Yes, right in front. The question was about the seasons. How will the pictures all show summer? So how will we deal with the seasons? There are some plants, there'll be clipped azaleas around the stones that are beautiful in spring. The maples, of course, and some of the other Enkianthus, some of the other plants in there are beautiful and brilliant in the fall. The structure of East Asian gardens is primarily an evergreen permanent structure. Lush flowering or complex flowering is not a big part of the garden design, and the seasonal changes are subtler. They also are sometimes borrowed. For instance, you will see from the garden seasonal changes outside the garden, seen over the wall. Winter, the garden will be closed, but that's mostly a maintenance thing. It won't be shoveled clean or protected that way. So it will only be open three seasons of the year. Yes. Right. The question was about maintenance in the Six Friends Garden. At the Johnson Museum, at the Tiger Glen Garden, we have a group of 25 people, mostly students, but also some local people and faculty members, who take part in caring for the garden. They come every day to brush it and clean it and water it. There's also monthly professional care and annual pruning that happens by a specialist who comes up to prune the pine. At the Six Friends Garden, part of the endowment for the garden is to endow a position for a person who would be caring for the garden. And in addition to that person, we would also need volunteer help to do sweeping and leaves and things like that. Those gardens really do read best when they're tidily kept. So part of that maintenance would be very important in the garden. Yes. It's about 7,000 square feet, but I'm not sure that even helps, because who knows what 7,000 square feet looks like. But you know the plateau I'm talking about? It's next to the Nevin Center. It's now just grass, but it's in between the knoll itself and a row of junipers, I think, that kind of shield it from sight. Almost that entire plateau will be taken over by this garden. That's right. So this Six Friends Garden, with the garden inside the walls and things that are happening around it as a buffer zone, is about 10 times the size of the Tiger Glen Garden. Yes. We have weaponry for that. I wanted to use running bamboo because running bamboo creates light, airy groves. That is very special. The plantations won't let me use running bamboo, so we're using clumping bamboo. If you don't know, bamboo basically has two forms. One are the runners, which send out long shoots and they sprout up everywhere and anywhere that they want to. And the other is a clumping form that starts out from a central node and really works out in rings. So we will plant clumps and thin them, and that's how we'll control it. Clumping bamboo doesn't need a barrier, it doesn't escape in the same way. Yeah. What about deer? We have weaponry for that. We don't have weaponry for that. Deer. So the design of the garden and the selection of plants has been done with deer in mind. And there is a possibility that some portion might be deer fenced at some point. I'm not sure before or after the garden or how that's going to happen. But most of this garden being primarily stone and evergreens and lotus and things like that, deer are not really such a big problem for this garden. Yes?
What is your desired time frame for starting?
Last week. That's not going to happen. We have to get approvals from Cornell. We have to fundraise. It's still probably a couple years, some years down the road. Yeah?
Will you be tying up the plants in the winter with bamboo trusses and all those beautiful things we see in Japanese gardens?
Well, the question was about tying things up in winter. The pine trees that are in the front court might require some kind of supportive structure. If they have very special branches that look like they might snap under ice and snow, we might support them like we do with the pine in the Johnson garden. We just put those up today. We put up braces under some of the branches in the pine tree at the Tiger Glen garden. And we might do that with the pines. But the other plants, the other plants don't need it for the winter. So it'll just be those pines, yeah. Yeah, Don.
To really put you on the spot.
Yes. The Japanese garden in Portland, Oregon, and in Denver, at the Botanic Garden in Denver, are very nice. The Chinese garden in Portland, Oregon, and the one down in Staten Island here are very nice, very nicely done. Yeah, both of those are quite traditional and include many traditional elements from gardens that would have existed, say, from the 1700s on, that period of time. Yes. Ouch. As you saw in the Chinese photographs, white plaster is the most typical, or no plaster, as with the rammed earth wall. It will just be soil, earth. Red is used. The red color is used quite a bit in China, or in some Japanese gardens. The red is iron oxide, and that's one of the common pigments around the world for coloring really anything, any early paint. So it's a very typical color for East Asia, the red. And in that front courtyard, having the trunks of the pine trees growing against that red color is what I had in mind. I didn't have Cornelian red in mind, but I can see I'll be pushed to make the color just right, yeah. Don't do it. Yes. Thank you very much.
You head out and head into the foyer and hopefully buy some of Mark's books. One of the benefits we now have in having the Nevin Welcome Center is being able to display different artists' art. all local and all somehow related to nature. And this Friday, we have an opening exhibit that's particularly special in that it was all done by the students of our local art professor, Gregory Page. And that exhibit is opening this Friday from 6 to 9. There'll be refreshments. Obviously, the building will be open, so we invite you to join us again there. Thank you so much. We will look forward to seeing you next fall with a new slate of wonderful lectures.